Okay, thanks very much for coming to this lecture. An introduction to scientific computing, of course. Such a topic can be, you know, full years of lectures, so it's very hard in two lectures to teach you anything. So what I expect from this lecture is that you get enough keywords that you can teach yourself what you need to learn about scientific computing if you really want to get into it. Because there's plenty of material. I didn't go to lectures. Well, actually, I did have some courses on CFD, but when I had to solve a problem, I had to teach myself to solve that problem using the material that's available. So this is just a two-lecture series. And I've used the little icon there of the little... my little logo there of a project that we've just started in this department. We've just started coordinating a European project on scientific computing, which involves some mobility grants and also online learning and international collaboration. So here, using this for two purposes. So what is scientific computing? Well, we mean by scientific computing basically the solution of scientific problems by means of simulation in computers. Now this is essentially a multidisciplinary activity involving, of course, computer science, but this is a very broad term that involves several things like compiler technology and information technology, and we don't mean those things. We mean a subset of computer science, which is the one that deals with numerical analysis, algorithm, software development, implementation, and those types of things. So we're using this term in a special way. Of course, it involves applied mathematics, developing algorithms, and some applied branch of science, physics, chemistry, biology, and engineering. So this is represented here in this Venn diagram to indicate that it's a multidisciplinary activity. It has been called the third pillar of science, because next to experiments and analysis, it combines to provide all the tools the scientist needs to solve scientific questions. But we can safely say that it is now a necessary avenue of inquiry in almost every field of inquiry. Science and engineering, okay. So what is it not? We all use computers, scientists always use computers, but scientific computing is not just a scientist using a computer, because we don't mean by scientific computing using word processing, typesetting, even though we may be using some very technical typesetting tools such as LaTeX, or any sort of publication production, web browsing, file transfer, email, or using any everyday applications, that's not scientific computing, even though it may be essential for the job of the scientist. It also is not only programming, so it's not just programming, because the full workflow of computational science includes several very complex interlocking tasks. First, the simulation setup, perhaps programming is only in this part, then the control, intelligent design of the avenues for inputting, executing, outputting, visualization of the data, that's very important, and this whole process leading to scientific discovery through several cycles over again. And so, it really, another way to look at the whole process is by thinking about the building blocks of computational science, and these building blocks are here described as basic theoretical research, that is, laying the foundations for the mathematical description of the phenomena that we want to discover. Scientific code development, this is where programming is, so it's not just programming. Providing mathematical algorithms, providing basic computer software, and also making efficient use of high-performance computing. And something that is often overlooked, it's a very important part of this whole business of computational science, which is scientific code validation. Benchmarking new software and comparing with experiments. This is often overlooked, and for that reason I'm going to describe this process in the next few slides. So, what is the whole process of scientific computing. Here are these three aspects we've discussed already: theoretical science, the applied mathematics aspect, that is developing the algorithms, the computer science aspect, and all of these combined in this term computational science, that is developing the scientific codes for scientific discovery. Using those scientific codes, we are able to produce computational predictions of a certain physical system and compare it to experiments. If the experiments disagree, then we have to go back and check either our computational method or the mathematical model or both, and repeat this cycle until we in fact agree with experiments. Once we agree with experiments, then we want to check the performance. If the performance is poor, we go back to the cycle of checking the scientific codes until we get good performance and we have a high-performance validated tool for scientific discovery. So basically, first we want to make the code work, then we want it to give the right answer, and then we want it to give the right answer fast. Those are the steps. So let me now explain a little bit what we mean by validation. Now, in English, in the language, validation, verification, even confirmation, they're all synonyms, okay? But here we're talking about these terms in the technical context. In the technical context, there has been an agreement regarding what we mean by these words, and in fact they are different in the technical context. Verification refers to solving the equations right, and validation refers to solving the right equations. What does that mean? So in verification, we are in fact just trying to define precisely what are the partial differential equations and boundary conditions that the code is solving, and then convincingly demonstrating that they are being solved correctly. So usually we want to be able to determine some degree of accuracy, we want to be able to determine some order of convergence, and such types of measures of the accuracy we are and demonstrating without any doubt that we're solving the equations right. So in fact, with that definition, and the definition of validation referring to solving the right equations, that is, are we actually representing the physical system properly, one could conclude that a code in particular cannot be really validated. It can be verified. It can be verified as a program that actually solves the PDEs and the boundary conditions correctly. But then a particular calculation can be validated for a specific class of problems in which we can compare with experiments. This is a very crucial distinction between numerical errors and conceptual modeling errors. For example, if we are using a perfectly well verified code that solves the incompressible Navier-Stokes equation, the code has been proven to be second order accurate, and we have been able to determine with a particular well behaved problem that the accuracy is very low, that doesn't mean that in a particular application it's going to give us the result we want, because perhaps the assumption of incompressibility does not apply to our problem. That is a modeling aspect, and it refers to the conceptual modeling aspect of scientific computing. So what we mean by verification, it was defined by Jay in 1984 as providing a formal proof of program correctness. So this is a bit more general definition than the previous one, but it's compatible with the idea of solving the equations right. Now, the step of verification should be completed without appeal to physical experiments. We don't need physical experiments to prove that a program solves the equations right. In fact, notice the word completed. Verification is not an ongoing process. One, for example, proves that a theorem is correct, and when we've proved it, it's finished, we're done. In the same way, once you prove that a code is correct, then you're finished with that step. So code verification should occur, in fact, before experimental validation. So as a builder of a code, then I should be able to tell you what equation my code solves, but I cannot tell you what equations you need to solve for your problem. Then I should be able to tell you the theoretical order of convergence of my code, and I should be able to actually tell you also the observed order of convergence. So those are two things. One is the theoretical order of convergence, and then I need to be able to prove that my code actually provides that convergence. Then I should be able to tell you also what grid refinement level was sufficient to attain asymptotic performance. But I cannot tell you what grid you require for your particular problem. So as a code user, you need to be able to carry out verification processes again for a specific calculation to determine, for example, the grid that you need to solve your problem. So what is this thing about order of convergence? Basically, the convergence is defined in terms of some form of measure of the error of the discrete solution. There are several measures of error, but basically we want to look at the difference between the discrete solution. Here this delta represents some sort of discretization, some grid perhaps, and we're looking at a definition of the error as the difference between the discrete solution and the exact solution. For an order P method, we expect that this error for a well-behaved problem will be proportional to some power of this delta, which represents here some measure of the discretization. It could be perhaps grid spacing, but it could be some other measure of discretization. Perhaps we don't have a grid, and then we have to use some other measure. So simply, P equals 2 implies a second order method. So we can do verification of a code with respect to, for example, a known analytical solution. With a known analytical solution, we can calculate this error, then we can refine this discretization and observe whether, in fact we have order P. In most applications, we don't have analytical solutions, but there's another way of verifying a code using the so-called method of manufacture solution. I'll just give you that keyword, and you can just go and Google it and find out what that is about if you're interested. And the process, either using analytical solution or manufacturer solutions, is to monitor the error as the grid is systematically refined. This is called a grid refinement study or a grid convergence study. Basically, we also need to be in a range in which we find that this constant here is indeed a constant. That is, we need to demonstrate that we are in the asymptotic range of the refinement. Once we are in the asymptotic range, then we can verify that order of convergence. So, another aspect of grid convergence study is the following. This is just a repeat of the previous formula. And so you can see here in this formula that if I neglect the higher order terms and take logarithm of this equation on both sides, then you can see that the logarithm of the error is approximately equal to the logarithm of a constant plus p times the logarithm of this grid refinement measure. So basically you can obtain the order of convergence from the slope of the curve logarithm of the error versus logarithm of the discretization. So if you have several discretizations, you calculate the error and you plot this in a log-log plot, you can extract this order P from the calculations. That is the observed order of convergence. But a more direct evaluation of this observed order of convergence can be obtained from three solutions, F1, F2, and F3, which differ from each other in a certain constant grid refinement ratio. So for example, if you have a constant distance between points in a grid and refine this, the refinement doesn't necessarily have to be an integer. Many times we cannot use an integer because, say, if you refine by a factor of 2 and then you refine again by a factor of 2, then you may have, in a two-dimensional problem, you would have, you know, a very large problem to solve and it might be too expensive. So then you can use this R here. Grid refinement simply means the ratio between the discretization measure, for example, the grid spacing between the finer and the coarser grid. You can use a number 1.1, 1.2, perhaps 1.3, such that you are actually able, with your computing power, to get three solutions. With this formula, you can get the observed order of convergence. And I cannot stress enough how important it is to get this in practice. I have been the witness in certain conferences of people presenting their newly developed methods for solving some particular problem, in which they claim this method is quicker, this method is efficient to solve a particular problem, and I have seen somebody in the back raising their hand and say, what's the order of convergence of your method? To just be faced then with a blank face to that question, which is extremely embarrassing, because at least you should be able to tell what the theoretical order of convergence of your method is. But then again, you have to be able to go one step further and say what the observed order of convergence has been in a grid refinement study. This is the only way that you can prove that your method is working correctly and that you're going to get people to believe in your numerical calculations. You can find those things, and I'll give you some references where you can find this, the derivation of these things, derivation of these formula, so that you can understand this if you're interested. It's most important to understand this. Another important thing to do after that step is, one thing is to say how quickly the method converges, and another thing is to say what is the error that we estimate in a particular calculation. So the previous step was in fact about verifying a code. And the next step is, in fact, about verifying a particular calculation, giving an estimate of the error in that particular situation. So in order to estimate the errors, we need to know the convergence rate. We know the convergence rate because we've already done a grid convergence study. So we know this is second order, fourth order, or whatever. And now we can use a very famous formula called Richardson extrapolation to actually estimate the exact solution, that is the continuum solution of the equation in with respect to a particular from the basis of two different solutions in two different grids, we can then estimate what the continuum solution would be. This is the formula, and you can look this up. In fact, you can Google these things and you can find several papers online that will explain to you where these things come from. But it's most important, if you're doing some computational science, to know about these things, to know about Richardson extrapolation, estimating the error of your calculations, and then being able to report these errors, especially in any journals that are specifically dedicated to numerical methods. So the next step is validating, that is comparing two experimental results. In general, validation has the highest priority for scientists because, you know, we tend to believe that nature is the final jury of a physical process. But you have to keep in mind that experimental data is not absolute. In fact, now we're faced with a situation that many calculations are more precise than the experiments that we're comparing with. So you have to be very careful when, if the results don't agree with experiments, that you're not suffering from false invalidation. That is, the experiments have errors, and those errors invalidate your calculations when the calculations are in fact correct. So that's something to keep in mind, and also to remember that validation is really an ongoing process, unlike verification. Verification is like a proof. Once you're done, you're done. Validation is ongoing because the precision of the experiment is changing all the time. But let me close this section with this famous, if you will, famous among people that do computational experiments. No one believes numerical results except the author of the calculation, but everyone believes the experimental results except the one who performed the experiment. And this is amazingly, time and again, I've seen this to be quite the trend among scientists. So let me just now give you a brief overview of the basics of numerical analysis. Most scientific computing deals with the same types of problems. We're solving ordinary and partial differential equations, systems of linear equations, vector and matrix operations, interpolation of functions, etc. It's the same type of things over and over again in, for most applications. So the basic message that I want to give you in this section is that you should not try to reinvent the wheel. So, basic numerical toolbox. Well, we basically need to do vector and matrix operations, function interpolation, we need to know about finite difference, approximations to derivatives, integration of functions, how to do this numerically, solving systems of linear equations, discrete Fourier transforms, nonlinear equations and optimization, time-stepping methods for ODEs, there's some stochastic tools that you need to know about, and never forget understanding errors, convergence, and stability issues. All of these are your basic toolbox for scientific discovery through numerical analysis. Just a very quick overview of the things, some keywords, in fact, of what is meant by all these titles here. Vector and matrix operations. Without a doubt, you're going to, at some point, need to do dot product, cross products, vector norms. You're going to need to get a maximum or minimum, do matrix products, matrix norm, and such. Function interpolation, we mean by this, well, if you have a data set, pairs of data, xi, yi, then the problem of interpolation is to find a reasonable function, f of x, such that the function satisfies the data points. The simplest, of course, is simple joining those points by line segments, but that is going to give you a function which is not continuous in the derivatives. So there are several other steps. You may try polynomial interpolation, but then you may have problems with wiggling of the polynomial in certain areas. So there are several other, Lagrange interpolation, Chebyshev, rational polynomials, Fourier interpolation, B-splines, and then again we can have the next step, which is to approximate a surface rather than just a line. So for all of these things, there you have some keywords. If you need to solve a problem of interpolation, you're going to look these things up. What we mean by finite difference is simply to be able to estimate a partial derivative in terms of discrete values on a grid. So you may have a forward difference formula like so, you may have a backward difference formula like so, or a central difference formula, and you should know central difference to be second order and forward and backward difference to be your first order. This is just the most basic formulas, of course, because there are several other methods to get higher derivatives, mixed derivatives, to solve boundary conditions, and all of those. Integration of functions. Well, the problem is simply how to find an approximate value of a given integral of a function where we only know discrete values of that integral. And your keywords there are rectangle rule, trapezoidal rule, the Newton-Cotes formula, Romberg, and Gauss formulas for integration. Solving linear equations, the basic problem is to find a vector in Rn such that Ax equals B, where B is another vector, A is an n by n matrix. The most the standard method of Gaussian elimination for general and full system is it's as good a method as you can get. However, it's very expensive. It's order n cubed for n dimensions, and it's also expensive in terms of memory, requiring order n squared memory. In addition, it's very prone to numerical errors, for which reason you use what is called a pivoting, that is to make the diagonal terms as large as possible. Basically, you won't find the method of Gaussian elimination being used without such a modification. But in addition to this basic method, there are several iterative methods such as Jacobi, Gauss-Seidel, successive over relaxation, and various conjugate gradient and other iterative methods. Next, discrete Fourier transforms. The basic problem is, if you have a function which is expressed in the time domain by little h, then one says that this is equivalent to describing another function, capital H, on the frequency domain, and one goes back and forth between time domain and frequency domain using the equations for the Fourier transform. And there's an amazing number of applications of Fourier methods in research. The problem then in the numerical aspect is to discretely express those Fourier transforms. And for discretely sampled data, one needs to be aware of the problem of aliasing. And one needs to know that there are two ways of solving the Fourier transform on discrete data, one of which is order n squared and the FAST method, which is one of the great algorithms of the 20th century, reducing the complexity to order n log n. Nonlinear equations refers to the problem of finding one or more solutions to such an equation, a nonlinear equation on a vector x. And the basic method for solving such a problem is Dieuton methods, where basically we are approximating the nonlinear function by the tangent line at each given point, data point xk. This method requires an initial guess, and a bad initial guess will probably give you bad results. So there are several technical things to consider in such a problem, which is also similar to the problem of minimization. Next basic problem in numerical analysis is solving ordinary differential equations, for which we have the basic methods, the basic Euler methods, forward and backward Euler, which are first order methods, and then various more advanced methods such as leapfrog, Runge-Kutta, and Adams-Bachstad. For these types of problems, one needs to be aware of the stability constraints of the methods. Finally, we have all sorts of stochastic tools, methods for calculating variance, correlations, random number generations, and Monte Carlo methods as well. Understanding errors is most important for the basic numerical analysis. Such thing as understanding modeling, roundup error, truncation error, consistency, what is the effect of having a bad initial guess, ill conditioning, what is the effect of having a bad mesh, etc. For all this numerical methods, what do you do? You want to actually implement any of those things. I cannot tell you any of those things in 15 minutes. It could be a whole semester course, but you can learn yourself by consulting numerical recipes. It's all online. In fact, if you can go to numerical recipes online and see if this works. My link didn't work, okay, but you can write it. Oh, yeah, it did. But if we go back to the presentation, this brings one very important question. As you can see there, we have numerical recipes in Fortran 77, numerical recipes in C, and numerical recipes in C++. So this poses the very important question, which programming language to use? And I think this is also an important question to keep in mind if you're going to be interested in solving any problem by programming your own numerical method. The problem of C++ versus Fortran. Now, first of all, C++ has very attractive features for scientific computing. We have the so-called templates for generic programming. You can learn more about that, and you can just Google it. There's a lot written about templates. C++ has the capacity of operator overloading for expressiveness, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. And of course, we have object orientation for abstraction of code review, and I'll tell you, have a couple of slides about what this means. But nevertheless, we find that if you go and talk to most numerical groups, you will find that most people are using Fortran. And why are they using Fortran? Fortran is basically a 30-year-old language, but many people are just using it because they are stuck with lots and lots of legacy code. What this means, and I had the experience during my PhD as well, that My supervisor had several generations of students that have been working on these codes, and they were all in 1477 because, of course, this research was initiated some, 15 years ago, and I was stuck here with trying to work with somebody else's 1477 code. Now, I made the decision personally at some point after 1 year of working with somebody else's 1477 code that I was going to start over again with my own C++ code. Now, perhaps I paid the price and perhaps I didn't get my PhD as fast, but I do not regret that decision. And let me tell you why. The problem, usually people will cite about what the real reason, I think, is this, because of the legacy code. But the reason that people will cite as to why they are using Fortran rather than C or C++ is that Fortran is a lot faster for number crunching. And in fact, it was a lot faster until the early 90s. At that time, benchmarks showed C++ to be between 20% and 10 times slower than Fortran for certain applications. But the performance of C++ has increased very much in the last 10 years. The clues are in better optimizing C++ compilers and new library techniques for solving certain problems, such as inline operations and such. So my recommendation is to really think about it before settling for good old Fortran. And I think it's worthwhile to just have a couple of slides about what we mean by object orientation, so that you just, if you don't know, you get an idea of this concept. The essential properties of object-oriented software are three. One is called data encapsulation or abstraction. What this means, encapsulation, means that in an object, say, for example, a data structure that was defined to have certain characteristics and certain responses to, for example, a particle that has velocity, mass, and response to an acceleration, for example, that's an object. A data abstraction, it has an internal structure that it hides from the rest of the system. This is called hiding the implementation, and it means that an object, once it is fully tested, is guaranteed to work ever after. So what this means is, for example, if you define an object to be a particle, and this particle has a mass, has a sign perhaps, a charge, and has a velocity, those are its characteristics, and you have a set of code that calls this object and does things in the particle, then later on you decide that you're going to have a particle that, in addition to mass, has some other property, and so you change the design of the object to have this additional property, but the interface with the whole rest of the world continues to be the same, and so all the other code that uses the object particle does not need to be rewritten. This is the clue to encapsulation, and it means that codes are going to be easier to maintain. The other essential property of object orientation is called class hierarchy and inheritance. And it is also a very important property, which you do not find in Fortran. So first, what a class means is a description of all the properties of certain objects of one given type, like the example I just gave, a particle. The properties can be structural, static, for example, the mass of the particle, or behavioral, dynamic, for example, how a particle responds to a given force. Static properties are described by variables, and dynamic properties are described by methods. The method defines how a particle, for example, responds to a given force by changing its velocity. Then the next concept is inheritance, which is the ability to derive the properties of an object from those of another, which is called the superclass. So now I can define another object, which is called a nucleus. And I define the nucleus to be a particle, and therefore it inherits all those properties of the class particle, but I define it to be, for example, instead of a nucleus, let's say we're talking about a proton. So the proton, I define it to be always positive. So it's a subclass of particle, but it has a particular property, which is it doesn't have a sign, it only is always positive. Or the same way, if we have a particle which is an electron, it inherits all the properties of the the class particle, but it is defined to be always negative. That is the concept of inheritance. And the third concept, which is polymorphism, which is the ability to manipulate objects from different classes, which are not related, with a common set of methods. And this is related to the concept of operator overload. For example, if you define a method to be the operation add, and then that operation add, you can use it in objects of different types. For example, you could use it in an object which is a vector, you can use it on an object which is a matrix, or an object which is a list. And for each object, the operation will do something different, but the interface is the same. You just say x plus b or x plus y, and you get a given result, and depending on the type, you will get what you expect, depending on the type of the object. So, once again, encapsulation. This is a representation, a cartoon of an object, and the object is characterized by variables, which is just data. The data is prior to the object. The user need never peek inside the object to see those variables. And then there's a set of methods, which is the behavior of the object or the interface with the rest of the code. So basically, in object-oriented programming, code and data are merged together in this single thing, which is the object. Unlike structured programming, where data and procedures are separate from each other. The result is maintainability and also reuse. The fact that we have the property of inheritance means that you can reuse parts of code. The best example for scientific applications is vectors and matrices. That's the most fundamental type of module that are needed in our types of computing. Classes for storing and manipulating arrays of numbers. Neither C nor Fortran provide good abstractions for arrays. In C, you can't use arrays as a first class object, although you can actually code in some special, you can do it, but you have to program it yourself. Fortran came missing there, lacks the capability for dynamic resizing of arrays, and neither language lets you express operations on arrays at a high level. You must use explicit loops to do any vector operations. So, my opinion is that even if you use no classes beyond just a set of vector, matrix, and array types, a good array class library can make the transition from C or Fortran worthwhile. And here's an example of polymorphism. A function such as add, this piece of code, w equals x plus y plus z, this will behave differently depending on the type of object invoking it. X, y, and z could be vectors, matrices, or scalars, but once you have defined through a class library what the operation add does to a vector or a matrix, all you have to write is one line of code for any of those. But of course, when you're developing an algorithm, you can bypass all of that by going straight to MATLAB, where of course things that can be very complicated to program, such as solving a linear system of equations for all different types of matrices A, semi-positive definite or sparse or bounded or whatever type of matrix, would perhaps result in different types of programming. In MATLAB, you perhaps would use just a simple backslash operator and get the answer. MATLAB will be smart enough to give you a different answer and use a different method depending on what type of matrix this is. You get a warning if the matrix is nearly singular, and you even get a least square solution if their exact solution doesn't exist. But for challenging real-life problems, one can quickly run out of memory or CPU, and so perhaps the combination of these two things, using MATLAB for algorithm development in small programs, and then once an algorithm works, translate to C++ with MPI, is a good formula for large-scale scientific computing. And if you find that MATLAB is too expensive, then you can use Octave, which is free and is perfectly compatible with MATLAB. If you find MATLAB is too hard, then, well, get a book, read the help, but then you can also go to this very useful forum where you can ask questions, and I've had the experience of having a very little tiny problem which you don't know how to solve, it's nowhere in the help, and after hours of pulling your hairs out, you just write a little message to this forum and get the answer in less than half an hour. Another useful package is Scilab. Let me just show you quickly if this works, the web page of Octave. Wheel and use published algorithms and packages. Which brings me to just a couple of more slides. One is an overview of the numerical libraries, and then I just want to give you a taste of what the next lecture is going to be about, which is the most important algorithms of the 20th century. And in addition, the next lecture, I'm also going to concentrate on parallel programming. Numerical libraries are fundamental to scientific computing. Before writing one line of code, my suggestion is to find out what libraries are available to help you with your problem. Once again, the message is don't reinvent the wheel. There's a long history of numerical libraries through NetLib. NetLib was created in 1985 for cost-effective and timely distribution of freely available, high-quality mathematical software. At the time, distribution of software was carried out in big, heavy tapes, magnetic tapes. And so a series of people got together to create NetLib, which worked with an email interface. You just sent an email and you got an automated response. A server sent you the code you needed. It still works in this way, but now in addition there's an HTML interface to NetLib. The collection now has grown to include a lot of other software, not only mathematical software, but also networking tools, tools for visualization and multiprocessor performance, technical reports, information about conferences, and much more. All the traditional numerical analysis errors are covered. Linear systems, eigenvalue problems, quadrature, all sorts of problems have some library there that will perhaps, if you can't use it straight from the box, you can copy some lines of code because it's all open source and you can look at the source. The basic library from the 80s and until today is called BLAST, the Basic Linear Algebra Subprograms, and it provides high quality building block routines for vector and matrix operations. There are three levels. Level 1 is for vector-vector operations, level 2 for matrix-vector, and level 3 for matrix-matrix operations. They're efficient and portable libraries, and they are included and used in many high-quality linear algebra software such as LimPack and LatePack. So one quick look at NetLib on the web. LatePack++, an interface in C++, etc. LimPack and LatePack, there's some links there, but we're not going to use them. We're running out of time. In the interest of time, I'm going to go to the next slide. ScalePack, a subset of LatePack routines designed for distributed memory and parallel computers. Atlas, automatically tuned linear algebra software. And these are just some examples. And then I have a link for a table form of all the sorts of free linear algebra software that you can find, and I will show you this one. Not to try to reprogram those things because it's a waste of time. So finally, my last couple of slides is just to give you a taster of modern algorithms. The importance of developing intelligent numerical algorithms cannot be stressed enough, and it leverages huge hardware investments because Moore's law at some point is going to stop, and then now we have all sorts of problems with heating up of computers, and so the investment in numerical software and intelligent algorithms is going to give much more benefits. The top 10 algorithms of the 21st century have been, well, of course, there can be many opinions, but some very well-informed people developed this list, of the top 10 algorithms of the 20th century, and I will give a brief description of what these are in the next lecture, and perhaps more details about a couple of them, in particular the fast waterfall method. Monte Carlo method in the 40s, the simplest method for linear programming, the Krylov subspace iteration method for solving linear systems of equations in the 1950s, decompositional approach to matrix computations such as the QR decomposition, the Fortran compiler, which liberated the scientists from using assembly language in the late 50s, QR algorithm for computing eigenvalues, quicksort algorithm for sorting, the fast Fourier transform, integer relation detection, and fast multiple method. All of these are algorithms which had a huge impact on the capabilities of computational science. And I will concentrate a little bit on the fast multiple method next week, and also talk about, in particular, the parallel paradigms and the implementation of numerical methods in parallel computers. And that's it for today. Thanks very much.